To this day, Israel has never acknowledged that it has a nuclear arsenal, instead maintaining a policy of nuclear ambiguity, while Western governments have played along with the policy of opacity by avoiding all mention of the issue. To discuss this issue with us from the city of Cork in Ireland is Gregory Casey, political commentator. Thank you for being with us, Gregory. Now, in an extraordinary feat of subterfuge, we have Israel managing to assemble an entire underground nuclear arsenal, now estimated at 200 warheads on par with India and Pakistan, and even tested a bomb almost half a century ago with a minimum of international outcry or even much public awareness of what it is doing. What gives Israel the right to do so?
Well, in my humble opinion, Israel has no right whatsoever to do this. This has been ongoing since the late 1950s, 1960s, when the French secretly gave the Israelis the nuclear technology to enable them to build a nuclear missile. There have been varying estimates as to the amount of missiles that are in place in the facility, ranging from 200 to 400. With all due respect to the Israelis and to everybody else, all it takes is one nuclear warhead to flatten half the Middle East. You don't need 200 of them or 400 of them. But what's even more frustrating is that the IAEA, I was looking last night at some pictures of a representative of the IAEA congratulating himself on coming to an agreement with Iran for continuing inspections of the Iran's peaceful nuclear facilities, while at the same time the IAEA has simply no interest whatsoever in establishing what's on site in Israel, how many warheads they have, or having Israel come into compliance with the IAEA. Mm-hmm. The hypocrisy on the part of the IAEA by the European Union, specifically in my instance, because I'm a European citizen, is staggering. Mm-hmm.
Well, Gregory, Dimona, which is widely believed to be key to Israel's nuclear arms manufacturing program, was built back in the 50s with covert assistance, as you mentioned, by the French government. And it was activated sometime between 1962 and 1964. Yet the U.S. was kept in the dark for some years, and it was disappointed when Israel actually kept the site a secret one. How would a nuclear program like that of Israel actually affect the U.S.'s influence in a region like West Asia?
To be perfectly honest, given the history of the Israeli presence in West Asia, if we go back to 1973, it is now established from, you know, the opening up of the archives of the U.S. State Department, amongst others, that in 1973, the Israelis threatened to explode a nuclear bomb in the Sinai as a warning to the Egyptians. Apparently, they were persuaded that it was not necessary for them to do so, mm-hmm. but the threat was made. Now, as I said earlier, how many bombs does it take to detonate in the Middle East to flatten the entire place from the Hindu Kush to the Mediterranean? To be perfectly honest, I mean, you mentioned 200 earlier on. Mm-hmm. I think most independent commentators now maintain that there are, in fact, up to 400 missiles.
Well, that's the interesting part here, Gregory, because the issue is, if actually Israel chooses to use any of its warheads, it will for sure risk its own security inside the occupied Palestinian territories, hence causing a disaster against its own colonial settlers and against the Palestinians, the Jordanians, the Lebanese, the Egyptians, and the Syrians as well as the Mediterranean Sea. I mean, what exactly is the point of stockpiling such number and amount of weapons of mass destruction in such a place?
Well, either it stems from a great insecurity, or it is essentially a form of warmongering. Mm-hmm. And look at me, see how powerful I am, how dare you challenge me. The fact of the matter is that regardless of what US interests might be in the Middle East, when you break it down, ultimately, Israel will do what's in Israel's interests. It will follow its own. It will follow its own line. And the head of the armed forces of Israel, together with Bibi, I think 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, made crystal clear that they were very much against the U.S. return to the nuclear agreement with Iran. That, as far as they were concerned, it made no difference, because one way or the other, as far as they were concerned, Iran is a malign influence in the Middle East. The fact of the matter is, the malign influence in the Middle East is not Iran, it's Israel. Mm-hmm. And having a stockpile of 400 nuclear missiles sitting in the Negev that hang essentially over the people of the Middle East in perpetuity is simply outrageous. I mean, you know, America in 2015 under Obama set aside a program of $1 trillion for quote-unquote renewal of its nuclear arsenal over the following 10 years up to 2025. What nobody has been able to establish is how much of that money, of that $1 trillion, has been set aside in support of the Israeli nuclear arsenal at a time when, you know, the great game between the USSR, Soviet Union, America, and, you know, Europe in the middle, is long since over. It's 30 years, 32 years since that came to a finish. I really have to ask, and any reasonable person would have to ask, why in the name of God does Israel require 400 nuclear missiles? It does not.
Well, Gregory, we did hear Iranian Foreign Minister. We did hear Iranian Foreign Minister Javad Zarif lashing out at European leaders and the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, for turning a blind eye to Israel's quiet expansion of the Dimona nuclear power plant, or nuclear plant. Actually, it's not a power plant; it's a nuclear facility for warheads in the occupied Naqab desert, while targeting Tehran's nuclear program, which is a peaceful one. Do you think that will affect the JCPOA in any way?
Well, I certainly think in the context, I was listening to, I think his name is Tevridis, this morning on MSNBC, saying that, you know, America should return to the IAEA with, to the JCPOA with Iran, mm-hmm. but it would be conditional and that they would require Iran to do far more. Because the term of that agreement has almost expired. I think it will expire in next year or the following year. Mm-hmm. And yet, it's crickets, complete silence on the fact that Israel has these warheads. As I said earlier, if it had one, that would be bad enough. Mm-hmm. If it has 200, I mean,
exactly. This is where I want to get off. Where we were sure have you back again, Gregory Casey from Cork, Ireland, a political commentator, to talk more about this matter. Unfortunately, that's all the time that we have for this segment. I want to thank you for being with us. Now, please stay tuned. We will continue talking about this matter from our next guest from inside Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Israel is considered to be the fifth nuclear power in the world. In addition to owning nuclear bombs that can be dropped from the air, its nuclear arsenal includes also nuclear warheads that can reach a distance of 1,500 kilometers using the Israeli-made Jericho missiles. Estimations show that Israel is in possession of at least 200 nuclear bombs, but other sources indicate that Israel actually owns massive quantities of uranium and plutonium that enables it to produce an additional 100 bombs. Dimona, a mystery threatening West Asia, in this following report.
The Israeli nuclear reactor of Dimona is vulnerable to meltdown, like the Russian reactor of Chernobyl almost four decades ago, which caused a humanitarian and ecological catastrophe. According to experts, if Dimona melts down, it would affect an area 500 aerial kilometers in radius, reaching Cyprus and the entire neighboring region. A study conducted by the Jordanian authorities back in the early 2000s after a request from the Palestinian Environment Quality Authority revealed that the Israelis are aware of the possibility of a meltdown in Dimona reactor, which in turn would affect the whole region, mainly the Jordanian southern city of Tafila. The study also showed that radioactive substances are leaking from the Dimona reactor in a way that has increased rates of cancer diseases among nearby population, particularly those of Tafila city. The location of Dimona's reactor in the Naqab Desert is a delicate one, situated between Egypt, Jordan, and the Palestinian-occupied territories. The reactor was built in the 50s as part of a deal with France, who pledged to build the reactor in exchange for helping it and the United Kingdom in attacking Egypt in what was known as the 1956 Tripartite. As for funding the reactor's driving material, the United States later took care of that, in addition to giving assistance with moving quantities of enriched uranium to Israel. The area on which the Dimona reactor is built on includes nine buildings, including the reactor building itself. Each building is tasked with producing a certain type of materials used to produce weapons of mass destruction, such as plutonium, lithium, and beryllium, used to manufacture nuclear bombs, in addition to producing radioactive uranium and tritium. The Dimona reactor is considered to be the most mysterious secrets of the nuclear world, as Israel categorically refused since its occupation began in 1948 and after building the reactor any routine inspection that other reactors around the world goes through. Israel is the only entity that opposes the inspection visits conducted by the International Atomic Energy Agency IAEA all over the world, added to its rejection until this very day to sign the Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons, which was signed by all surrounding Arab states.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Ramallah is Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Bir Zayed University. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Saad. Now, back in 2003, there was a study that was published at request by the Palestinian Ministry of Environment Quality from the Jordanian authorities, which revealed high cancer rates were recorded in all the southern Jordanian governorates, which confirmed the possible direction of nuclear dust that might be leaking from Dimona. This also confirms that Palestinian villages in and around the occupied Naqab area are all contaminated. How is that not the top priority for international human rights bodies?
As a matter of fact, yes, the Dimona reactor is becoming now a hazard, a big hazard in the southern part of Palestine. Not only that it affects the Palestinian villages and the Bedouin who are living in the Naqab Desert, and also the other parts of the West Bank, which is closer to a certain degree near Hebron, to this nuclear reactor, and also the Jordanian area. So it's not the leaking or the contamination that we have been noticing recently, and it's the numbers of Bedouin communities in the Naqab Desert who had cancer in a higher rate than usual. It's because of this reactor. So the whole idea is that not only that the Palestinian asked the Jordanian to do this kind of research on the Dimona reactor, but the problem is that it has become very old,
And apparently there isn't a good maintenance during that period, which might get that reactor to melt down or to explode in a way or another. And the Israelis, they don't care, especially that there is no international monitoring for their Dimona reactor. Because of that, it became really a big hazard and a big problem and issue today.
Well, it was revealed throughout the years that many Israeli colonial settlers lost their own family members who worked inside the Dimona reactor, and they filed charges against the Israeli government and against the management administration of the reactors, demanding compensation for the cancer that killed their own members of the family who worked inside the reactor and were exposed to radiation. Do such cases have maybe enough drive inside the Israeli settlers' communities to demand at least a termination for the site?
Well, it's quite true. The settlements, which is located in the Negev Desert near to the reactor, had suffered as well, like the Bedouin communities, the Palestinian Bedouin communities in that area, from the cancer. And it's true that some of these Israeli settlers filed cases against the reactor and its administration. But to what extent that would help or create a kind of an awareness inside Israel against the reactor to stop it and to shut it down, I doubt it, because north in Israel and the center of Israel in general, where is the most of the population there, they don't see that there is a big problem for them regarding the reactor. So I don't think that will make any kind of move. However, in the last few years, 2 or 3 years ago, there was a kind of a movement and a campaign, and particularly it was driven by the Palestinian Arabs living inside Israel against the reactor and to force Israel to go through the IAEA and to have their reactor inspected and to apply all the rules which is applied all over the world regarding the nuclear facilities all over the world. But the Israeli, I don't think that there will be a big campaign against the reactor, because within the Israeli mentality, they think that this is something for their own security in the region, and having a nuclear weapon in Israel is definitely for the benefit of the public in Israel. That's what they think. So I doubt that they are going to have a kind of a campaign. What? Unless the rate of infected people become
increases.
Really,
but the issue here is that if the internal occupied territories won't revolt against this, wouldn't this mean that at least the IAEA should oblige the Israelis to allow members of the agency to at least investigate the reactor? Can they do that?
Well, recently the Palestinian Authority and the Palestinians signed the agreements regarding the IAEA, though we have nothing to do with it, but, you know, to prevent such a thing to happen. So I think now it's about time that we should create a huge campaign internationally to force Israel to have the IAEA to inspect the reactor and to allow international experts to come to Israel and to Dimona reactor to inspect it and to put things within the right perspectives. But I don't think that the Israeli would allow such a thing, because already Israel refused so far all the calls to have their reactor inspected, and also they refused to join and to sign the treaty with the IAEA, and they refuse totally to have them inspect. So we need a huge campaign, not only locally from the Palestinians and from the Palestinians inside Israel, but also from the international community in general, to force Israel to accept the terms of the inspections.
Well, that raises a lot of questions concerning the visits and the inspections that happened in Iraq prior to the U.S. invasion, and now the wailing, the international wailing, the hypocrisy and the criticism against the Islamic Republic of Iran for simply deciding to stop the visits, not deciding to stop people from coming in the first place. They now decided to stop the visits of the IAEA until all sanctions are lifted. Do you think such a case, with the Dimona being brought up front in the region of West Asia, do you think this will affect the upcoming JCPOA agreement or negotiation in any way?
I should think so, yeah, because by the end of the day, it's quite obvious to everyone that the Western world, generally led by the United States and even with the Europeans, they are a huge hypocrisy in this respect. When they know that the Israelis do have a reactor and they do oppose a nuclear weapon, and they have bombs, nuclear bombs in Israel, but yet no one is talking about it. While when the Iranian tried to have a nuclear reactor for peaceful means, the Israeli as well as the Western world became really so mad about it, and they want to put all these kind of inspections and the visits to the sites and everywhere, but they don't talk at all about Israel. And I believe that now in the reopening of the negotiation back again for America to join back the agreement with the Iranian regarding the nuclear reactor in Iran, that the Iranian also should mention and should put this kind of a condition, that if you want to inspect us and you want to put some limits, then you have to do the same with Israel, especially that one who's leading the campaign against Iranian nuclear reactor is the Israeli, and always Netanyahu.
It's Benjamin Netanyahu himself doing a propaganda show in front of a big screen with the Iranian flag on it. We all watched it. We all laughed at the hypocrisy. But I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nimr Saad, academic at Birzeit University, for talking to us and telling us about the atrocities of the Dimona reactor inside Palestinian occupied territories. Thank you for being with us. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Mideast Stream.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, which was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. We start from where we left you last week, and here is Ayah 19 of Surah Ahqaf.
وَلِكُلٍّ دَرَجَاتٌ مِّمَّا عَمِلُوا وَلِيُوَفِّيَهُمْ أَعْمَالَهُمْ وَهُمْ لَا يُظْلَمُونَ.
For each person there will be degrees of merits pertaining to what he has done, that God Almighty may recompense them fully for their works, and they will not be wronged. If you remember, last Friday, in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said being dutiful to parents and doing good to them is a sign of expression of gratitude towards Allah for His bounties and results in the acceptance of good deeds in the divine court of the All-Merciful who forgives the faults one has committed. We also said that this respect for parents brings the wrath of God, while serving parents, especially the mother, paves the way towards paradise. In view of God's promise in the Noble Quran and the famous hadith of the Prophet, paradise lies at the feet of the mother. The ayah that we recited to you now means to say that on the Day of Judgment, Almighty Allah, after having shown much mercy to all His creatures, will raise the degrees of merit of the virtuous believers while punishing the disbelievers and unrepentant sinners for their evil deeds. In other words, divine degrees and stations are consistent with a person's deeds, and no one will be the least wronged. This ayah is continuation of the preceding two ayahs that we explained to you last week regarding obedient and disobedient children. It means that those who embrace the true faith, repenting their wrong deeds and beseech God to shower mercy on them and their parents, will indeed have exalted stations, while those who show disrespect to their parents, spurned their pleas against indulging in sins, and deny the veracity of the Resurrection Day, will be severely punished. The ayah teaches us that, number one, the fate of every person is in his or her own hands, and whatever one receives on the Day of Resurrection, whether reward or punishment, is the result of his or her words and deeds during the transient life of the mortal world. And number two, the passage of time does not obliterate our words, deeds, and their consequences, which are all meticulously registered in detail in a document, and on the Day of Judgment will be displayed to form as basis for reward or punishment. Now let us listen to ayah 20 of this surah.
وَيَوْمَ يُعْرَضُ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا عَلَى النَّارِ أَذْهَبْتُمْ طَيِّبَاتِكُمْ فِي حَيَاتِكُمُ الدُّنْيَا وَاسْتَمْتَعْتُمْ بِهَا فَالْيَوْمَ تُجْزَوْنَ عَذَابَ الْهُونِ بِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَسْتَكْبِرُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ بِغَيْرِ الْحَقِّ وَبِمَا كُنْتُمْ تَفْسُقُونَ.
The day when those who disbelieve are exposed to the fire, they will be told, "You exhausted your good things in the life of the world and enjoyed them. So today you will be requited with a humiliating punishment for your acting arrogantly in the earth unduly, and because you used to transgress." physical and mental torments are in store for disbelievers and unrepentant sinners on the day of resurrection, beginning with reproach, humiliation, and deep regret. Concerning the manner of dying, Imam Ali, peace be upon him, says in Nahjul Balagha, "In the last moments, a person thinks about what he has done during lifetime." This ayah refers to the manner of torments on the resurrection day, when disbelievers are exposed to hellfire. It will be said to them that the bounties that had been granted in mundane life, like health, property, wealth, comfort, and delicious food, as well as the mind, the intellect, the power of speech, and other capabilities such as courage, generosity, etc., were spent inappropriately, rather than employing them for the attainment of faith, felicity, virtue, perfection, and refrainment from sins. In other words, you spent them on pursuit of vain desires and pleasures of the flesh in violation of divine commandments. And today you face humiliating torments as a result of your misdeeds, since recompense is consistent with one's own actions. From this ayah we learn that, number one, God, the All-Merciful, has blessed the entire creation, whether believers or disbelievers, with His bounties in the transient life of the mortal world, in order to enable mankind to arouse the sense of gratitude and discern between faith and disbelief. Number two, sins and all negative characteristics, including greed, arrogance, oppression, and the like, makes a person exit from the path of truth. And number three, those who were arrogant during life will be subjected to severe humiliation on the day of resurrection. Now let us listen to ayahs 21, 22, and 23 of Surah Ahqaf.
وَاذْكُرْ أَخَا عَادٍ إِذْ أَنذَرَ قَوْمَهُ بِالْأَحْقَافِ وَقَدْ خَلَتِ النُّذُرُ مِنْ بَيْنِ يَدَيْهِ وَمِنْ خَلْفِهِ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا اللَّهَ إِنِّي أَخَافُ عَلَيْكُمْ عَذَابَ يَوْمٍ عَظِيمٍ قالوا أجئتنا لتأفكنا عن آلهتنا فأتنا بما تعدنا إن كنت من الصادقين قال إنما العلم عند الله وأبلغكم ما أرسلت به ولكني أراكم قوما تجهلون.
And mention Hud, the brother of Ad, when he warned his people at Ahqaf, and warners have passed away before him, saying, "Do not worship anyone but Allah. Indeed, I fear for you the punishment of a terrible day." They said, "Have you come to turn us away from our gods? Then bring us what you threaten us with, should you be truthful." He said, "The knowledge is with Allah alone. I communicate to you what I have been sent with, but I see that you are an ignorant lot." These ayahs refer to the mission of Prophet Hud, who was sent to guide his kinsmen, the nation of Ad, that lived in southwestern part of Arabia. Like all divine messengers, he warned the people of the dire consequences of idol worship and indulgence in sins. But most of them, especially the elite, instead of heeding his words and pondering upon them, scornfully told him that if he is really truthful, he should show some example of divine wrath. In reply, he told them that what they ask him to do is not in his power and solely with the All-Merciful God, who has entrusted him with a mission to guide them towards monotheism, good deeds, and the bliss of paradise. But it seems obstinacy and ignorance is preventing them from accepting the manifest truth. At times, polytheism and disbelief prevent people from discerning the truth of monotheism and belief, which are considered deviation by those worshipping idols and the imaginations of their warped minds. They mock the prophets, imams, saints, and scholars, and instead of contemplating on their words of guidance, demand that they bring torment upon them. The misfortune of such disbelievers has its roots in their ignorance and arrogance, which along with obduracy and false pride prevents them from heeding the voice of truth. It is said that because of their disobedience, the all-merciful God decreed famine, and for 3 years not a single drop of rain fell, in order to teach them a lesson. These ayahs teach us the following points. Number 1. The duty of divine messengers is to invite people towards the path of God by giving them tidings of the reward of paradise for the virtuous, and at the same time warning them of the dire consequences of polytheism, atheism, and other forms of disbelief so that they may wake up from their sinful life. Number 2. It is belief in the hereafter that makes the conscientious persons reform their behavior. And number 3, blind imitation of the illogical and harmful customs of the past on the assumption of preserving one's culture is among the signs of ignorant people.
Around the world with reporters.
Venezuela's Congress, also known as the National Assembly, has requested the government of President Nicolas Maduro to expel European Union Ambassador Isabel Brillante out of the South American nation as a diplomatic action countering the recently launched sanctions from the EU against the Bolivarian Republic. The Maduro administration has denounced the European measures, describing them as illegal and harmful to the economy of Venezuela. Venezuelan officials say that the EU, along with the US government, are plotting to produce a humanitarian crisis in the Latin American country in order to bring down President Nicolas Maduro. Although a UN human rights envoy recently declared foreign sanctions on Venezuela have no legal basis and must be lifted, the EU has ratified its decision. Venezuelan authorities claim they will legally confront the sanctions.
Okay, van 34 meses.
The EU, just like the US, is criminally targeting Venezuela. However, this unfair aggression will not oust Maduro.
Meanwhile, in the opposition, some say elections in Venezuela would ease the elimination of sanctions.
If free elections were held here, all foreign sanctions would blow over, but Maduro refuses to do so.
Nonetheless, socialists insist that neither the EU nor the US can judge what free elections are.
We have already had free elections guaranteed by many foreign observers, so the EU and the US are lying for political purposes.
Caracas slams the EU over violating international law with illegal sanctions. The expelling of the European ambassador is widely seen as a response to the bloc's economic policies against Venezuela. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
This is a specialized meeting on the latest studies on the coronavirus, organized and hosted by Bagayatullah University, the event brought together epidemiologists, virologists, and other medical experts to present their team's latest findings on prevention and treatment of COVID-19.
We tried the so-called plasmapheresis in treating COVID-19 patients. What is plasmapheresis? It's a method of removing blood plasma from the body and re-injecting it into the bloodstream. We conducted this method on 28 COVID patients and it was effective so far. We need to gather a large sample to achieve more reliable results.
We conducted a single-centered retrospective observational study of 60 laboratory-confirmed COVID patients and administered low-dose prednisolone in combination with naproxen and lopinavir. This helped reduce the length of patients' hospitalization.
Since the pandemic broke out in Iran, Baghiyatullah University has dedicated its R&D centers to COVID-related projects. So far, it has launched 200 research projects that seek to find a way to tackle the pandemic. Among them is a recombinant-based COVID vaccine that is making its way to the human trial phase.
We are wrapping up the animal trial stage and will soon begin the human trials of our vaccine. Our university has become a hotspot of major projects that center on COVID-19. We were amongst the first center that proposed plasma therapy for COVID-19. We're also conducting research on stem cell therapy and other viable treatments for the novel disease.
With the Baghiyatullah vaccine, Iran now possesses three viable candidates that have made their way to the human trial. Covfars, which is a recombinant vaccine, and Coviran, which works based on a weakened coronavirus. This, as Iran has already started its mass inoculation program using Russia's Sputnik V.
Baghiyatullah Hospital has since day one been one of the most active places in the fight against COVID-19. Now, as many biotech firms are concentrating their efforts on prevention and vaccine development, this center has also paid attention to treatment. Researchers here say they're very close to an effective COVID medicine. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Almost 1 year after the first positive case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Afghanistan, the country has now launched its first COVID-19 vaccination campaign. Representatives of medics, Afghan armed troops and journalists are the first ones who will receive doses of AstraZeneca's COVID-19 vaccine donated earlier this month by India.
Today I congratulate the people of Afghanistan on the launch of the first stage of COVID-19 vaccination. This is a big opportunity for the people of Afghanistan. I request all government bodies, media, and our religious scholars to cooperate with each other to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign smoothly.
Afghanistan received 500,000 doses of AstraZeneca's vaccine from the Serum Institute of India, which is producing the vaccine for mid- and low-income countries, earlier this month. The spread of COVID-19 in Afghanistan hardly hit the Afghan society due to mismanagement and lack of medical equipment. However, officials here say the government is committed to implement COVID-19 vaccination campaign all over the country.
We don't expect any miracles. We need full collaboration of the entire society. So let's help this campaign to be implemented justly.
Taliban has announced its backing for the vaccination campaign. However, the inoculations comes amid relentless violence despite intra-Afghan talks. As official statistics estimate, up to 10 million Afghans that make nearly a third of the population might have been infected with the coronavirus. Nearly 60,000 confirmed cases of COVID-19 and over 2,000 deaths have been recorded so far. Afghan officials say the pandemic is still a serious problem for the country and urge health workers to vaccinate the whole nation in a fair and transparent manner. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
The passage of time will never let the world forget the war crimes former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein committed against the innocent Iranian people. As part of its heinous crimes, the Iraqi dictator bombarded northwestern city of Sardash in 1978, killing 119 innocent civilians and exposing more than 8,000 to toxic gases, which maimed them forever. But Saddam was not alone in this 8-year war, and there were several countries, including Germany, France, the UK, and the US, that assisted him by arming his regime by chemical weapons. The Islamic Republic has always stressed that those complicit in Saddam's war crimes must be brought to justice. Therefore, in the presence of the country's top officials, an international conference was held in Tehran to look into the legal and international claims of the Islamic Republic in this regard.
Many countries gave Saddam intelligence, political, economic, military, and media support. All the world witnessed that these countries all stood against the great nation of Iran, but the United Nations could not play its role. The UN did not declare the Iraqi regime as the aggressor and the perpetrator of war. This is the question that the international community must ask the UN. Why the Security Council did not stop the aggressor from committing crimes against the Islamic Republic?
In the face of the chemical attacks, the international community turned down Tehran's frequent requests for deployment of experts for field investigations, something that Iran's foreign minister blasted during this event.
The Iraqi regime used chemical weapons against Iranian civilians and non-civilians, and also the Iraqi people. In 6 or 7 reports by the United Nations, it was declared that the chemical weapons were first used against military forces and then civilians. But the United Nations does not have a good record in supporting international law, and during the imposed war, it did not even use the means to make power balance.
It was also stressed at this conference that the assassination of the former Iranian IRGC Quds Force commander General Qasem Soleimani is top on the agenda to be followed up as part of this plan. Thinkers and researchers from 17 countries presented their papers on the legal aspects of the imposed war on Iran. These experts in both virtual and in-person methods elaborated on how the foreign countries helped Saddam's regime in killing civilians. Human Abedi, Tehran.
Delivering a speech at the 46th session of the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro denounced the damaging effects of ongoing illegal sanctions by the U.S. and its allies against the Bolivarian Republic. Maduro outlined that Washington, following its regime change policy, leads a coalition of states that the European Union is part of, which is implementing a long series of punishing measures to deliberately bring about a humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and overthrow his administration. Maduro mentioned details of these measures.
Through illegal measures, Venezuela has been deprived of $30 billion in cash, which are part of the assets of the Republic abroad.
In this light, the socialist president strongly condemned the U.S. government and its allies over their abusive actions against the Venezuelan people.
Those who have taken away Venezuelan assets and resources have shown their cruelty, even worse at a time of a pandemic.
Although some opposition figures in Venezuela argue that the U.S. sanctions are a needed political tool to force anticipated elections in the Latin American country, legal analysts say that such sanctions are totally illegal and unacceptable.
What the U.S. is doing to our nation violates international law and all human rights instruments. There is no way to justify such a crime.
President Maduro denounced over 450 illegal sanctions U.S. and its allies imposed on Venezuela. Maduro pointed out that despite the massive economic aggression, his socialist government will not be overthrown. Jesus Silva, Caracas.
The Gaza Strip began its coronavirus vaccination campaign using the Russian Sputnik V vaccine. Medical workers will be the first to receive the jabs. The vaccination comes after long delays by the Israeli regime that only allowed a small shipment of the vaccine to reach Gaza last Thursday, after coming under heavy criticism by human rights organizations. Another shipment of the Russian vaccine arrived then through the Egyptian-controlled Rafah crossing on Sunday.
Today, we begin the vaccination of COVID-19 in the Gaza Strip, and God willing, we will be able to control the spread of the deadly virus and have herd immunity.
Nearly 55,000 people in the blockaded Gaza Strip have been infected with the coronavirus, mostly since late August 2020. Some 550 Gazans have also died of COVID-19.
The Gaza Strip is one of the most overpopulated areas in the world. Vaccination will play a major role in preventing the coronavirus pandemic and lowering the number of deaths in case we can manage to inoculate people as soon as possible. First doses would go to frontline medical workers, vulnerable patients, and the elderly.
Local authorities in the Gaza Strip struggled for months to lower the coronavirus infection rates through strict measures. The Israeli blockade has compounded the struggle of health workers in Gaza, undermining their efforts to contain and track the spread of the coronavirus.
This vaccination campaign is one of the main measures of the Ministry of Health to control the spread of this pandemic, along with other protocols. This vaccine will give immunity to those who receive it, and in turn will lower the number of daily infections.
Hundreds of Gazan patients have already lost their lives in recent years due to the Israeli regime's inhumane practices under the watchful eye of the international community.
As vaccination begins in the blockaded enclave, experts say Tel Aviv must end its illegal policies and remove any barriers that may hinder Palestinians from accessing proper medical care. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The highly anticipated February 22nd announcement is finally here, marking what the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson calls his roadmap out of lockdown, following pressure from members of his own Conservative Party to explain how he plans to reopen the country.
We cannot persist indefinitely with restrictions that debilitate our economy, our physical and mental well-being, and the life chances of our children.
But restrictions won't be lifted in one fell swoop. Measures will be conditional based on four tests, with the government set to examine the data at each stage before unlocking further.
One of the first places to reopen, schools, which the Prime Minister, not long ago, described as potential vectors of transmission, causing the virus to spread between households.
In the devolved nations of Wales and Scotland, pupils have already gone back to school. We asked a number of parents in London what they thought of their kids returning to classrooms.
Well, they've lost nearly a year of schooling, so they definitely need to get back to school.
As long as people are sensible and the schools, I think they've taken all the necessary measures to keep the children safe, then I'll be glad for him to go back to school.
There is still some risk involved, I suppose, but I'm hoping that, you know, as the vaccination program is going forward, and I hope this decision is supported by data.
Critics, among them leader of the opposition Labour Party, have criticized the government for missing the opportunity to jab the teachers and school staff.
If we'd used that last half term, that last week, to vaccinate teachers and school staff, we'd be having a better discussion about children back to school. But ideally on the 8th, I'll listen to what the Prime Minister says this afternoon. I hope he's got a good plan.
The government says it does, and that it hasn't vaccinated teachers and school staff for a reason.
There isn't strong evidence that teachers are more likely to catch COVID than any other group, because children are very, very rarely get symptoms or serious illness from the disease. The value, the importance of vaccinating children is to try to stop the spread of the disease.
At the moment, although death and infection numbers have gone down, there are still almost 20,000 people in British hospitals with COVID-19, and it's going to take months before everyone gets their first jab. It remains to be seen if this is indeed the beginning of the end for lockdowns in this country. Saeed Puriza, London.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has slammed what he called the arrogant, high-handed, unjust and erroneous rhetoric of the European signatories to the 2015 nuclear deal toward the Islamic Republic. Ayatollah Khamenei also denounced Britain, France and Germany for failing to comply with their commitments under the nuclear agreement. The leader also lashed out at Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has repeatedly accused Iran of trying to acquire nuclear weapons. The leader added that Iran will never bow down to U.S. pressure and will not back down on its logical stance on its nuclear program. Elsewhere in his remarks, Ayatollah Khamenei referred to a law passed by the Iranian parliament in late December that requires the government to take additional action to reduce commitments to the nuclear deal, which includes a decision to end the voluntary implementation of additional protocol. The leader said Iran will develop its nuclear capabilities in line with the needs of the country, and for this reason, Iran's enrichment purity level will not be limited to 20%. He said Tehran may increase the level to 60% if it deems necessary.
We should remember that the framework about around this whole thing here is that a number of nuclear powers are sitting telling what Iran should do, which is not a nuclear power, while other nuclear powers are not even discussed.
Following the U.S. withdrawal from the nuclear agreement and its reimposition of sanctions in May 2018, Tehran exercised patience and remained fully committed to its obligations under the accord. However, a year later, Iran started to reduce its commitments in five gradual steps every 60 days, citing the failure of the European signatories to the JCPOA to uphold their end of the deal. In the meantime, Iran's ambassador to Vienna-based international organizations, Kazem Gharibabadi, said on Monday that Tehran has terminated the voluntary implementation of additional protocol, which allowed snap inspections of Iranian nuclear sites. On Sunday, Iran and the UN nuclear watchdog reached an agreement for the continued inspection of Iranian nuclear sites for 3 months. Gharibabadi said Iran would record information at certain nuclear facilities without the supervision of the inspectors as per the new agreement. The administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has recently expressed willingness to participate in an informal JCPOA meeting with Iran and other signatories. It has offered to hold talks with Iran over how to return to the deal. This is why Iranian officials have repeatedly and unequivocally rejected any preconditions or talks on the U.S. return to the deal, arguing that it was the U.S. that abandoned the accord and violated the U.N. Security Council 2231 that endorsed the multilateral agreement. Tehran says it will reverse its scalebacks to its commitments under the deal once all sanctions are lifted and all the signatories go back to full compliance.
After weeks of negotiating in Amman, the head of Yemen's National Committee for Prisoners' Affairs says the talks have ended without making any progress due to the inflexible approach of the delegation of former government backed by Saudi Arabia. The committee says it has made several proposals to overcome the differences, all in vain.
There are many reasons that caused the failure of the negotiations, including that the other party presented new names that did not exist before and changed the list that was agreed upon. Another reason is that the Islam Party, one of the parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition, wants to free its members only. A third reason is that they don't have one delegation to negotiate, but rather multiple delegations representing different parties affiliated with the Saudi-led coalition.
A member of the Supreme Political Council, Mohammed Al-Houthi, described the Saudi-backed delegation's refusal of swap deals as a crime. He said the failure of talks is a message from Saudi Arabia and its allies that they are not serious about any solution that may end the suffering of the Yemenis. He said their calls for peace are not in line with any real action. More than 15,000 Yemenis were captured in battlefronts by both warring sides since the beginning of the war in March 2015. Of these prisoners, only more than 1,000 were released in 2020 under a UN brokered deal, while hundreds of others have been freed through local negotiations. The release of thousands of Yemenis from Saudi prisons needs more efforts by the United Nations to pressure the representatives of the former government and the Saudi-led coalition to stop hampering the swaps. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Limelight. Texas oil refineries released hundreds of thousands of pounds of pollutants, including benzene, carbon monoxide, hydrogen sulfide, and sulfur dioxide into the air as they scrambled to shut down during last week's deadly winter storm, Reuters reported recently. Dear listeners, stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins Ryder. This article is published under the heading No Safe Amount. Environmentalists sound alarm over Texas refineries' release of hundreds of thousands of pounds of pollutants during storm. Here's the details.